Welcome to Help and Hope. Today's podcast is another in our series of highlights from past CCEF national conferences. From the 2008 conference, Phil Monroe shares counseling strategies for individuals with addictions. Addicts present unique challenges to counselors. This session will explain counseling goals and practical strategies common to a wide variety of problems associated with addictive behaviors, attitudes, and motivations. Here now, Help and Hope.
I have two goals here for this hour, and I will talk fast. I apologize in advance, but I can't change it. I want us to consider practical methods to help those struggling with addictions grow in insight and find that way of escape. If it is true that 1 Corinthians 10:13 says that no matter the temptation, there is a way of escape, part of our job is to put feet on that and find that way of escape for the people that we're working with. It is good to have foundations to understand what it is we're trying to do, and that's what you heard in the plenary sessions this morning. But there's also, practically, how do you start walking with somebody who's struggling? And so I'm going to give two techniques with that. And the second technique is how to tailor what you are doing to the needs and the character and the place that that person is. And we'll get more into that. It's good to have a little foundation. I promise it won't take too long of our time, that we will spend most of our time on the techniques. And by the way, I shouldn't have to say this, but techniques don't save anybody. Techniques aren't magic pills. If they were, I'd be a wealthy man, and we wouldn't need counseling. But they are necessary. It's not good to stand on the mountaintop and say, just come on up here, without getting down and walking with somebody. So let's quickly go through some of these foundational points. What is addiction? Shouldn't have to take too much to define this, but addiction is a body, a spirit, and a will problem. We should not segment any one of these problems off. Oftentimes, family members will just see it as a will problem. You can just stop this. Well, there is a will involved, but that's not the only thing involved. There is a spiritual blindness that's involved, and there is a physical problems involved as well. Even with sexual and pornographic addictions, we understand from some of the research on the brain that those who are frequenting pornography, their brain lights up while they're watching it the way it would as if they were ingesting cocaine. And so it stands to reason that if somebody is frequently viewing pornography, they've got the same problems that you would expect somebody who's been using stimulant substances. So it's a body, spirit, and will problem. Don't segment anything off. Sin, of course, is both chosen and irresistible. None of you, including myself, are ever going to stop sinning until we see Christ. So it's irresistible at some level. Doesn't mean that we give up and give in, but it is irresistible. We are made to desire God. Shutting down desires is not God's plan for us. We are made to desire good things. We're made to desire God and also the creation that he has given us. Of course, with the fall, what's the problem? The problem is that we long for stuff that we can't have completely. Just little simple stuff, and I don't mean to be superficial about this, but if you have a really good dessert, well, maybe it's just me, but I wouldn't mind a second one. Because the first one wasn't fully satisfying. In fact, it can never be fully satisfying. And even if it's satisfying for this moment, I'll want one a little bit later. We long for things that are out of reach. Unfulfilled longings, Proverbs and Psalms teach us, are painful. It's not just that we shouldn't want these and it's just easy to say no. It's painful to say no. It's painful not to have things fulfilled. And as a result, when we face these painful things that are out of reach, we turn them into demands. So a good desire is good. The problem isn't the good desire, it's the demand. If you're familiar with Paul Tripp's material, you know that he talks about this, that we go from desire to demand, and then if I think that you're withholding something from me that I should have a right to, now I'm going to punish you for it. So the problem is the demand. C.S. Lewis says the problem is that we desire too little. We give up great relationship with God for a little bit of something now. We desire too little, not too much with addictions. And when we get trapped, what is the problem? The problem isn't just that we're trapped, but we mostly want to manage it rather than get rid of it. We hate the consequences, but we love the sin. Let's be honest. We do love certain sins. And we say we don't, and in part, we don't. But why do we keep coming back to them? There's something about them that we do love. If you've read Ed Welch's Addictions, A Banquet in the Grave, these two next slides are adapted from his material. Let's remember how we get into trouble. You remember the young man in Proverbs who makes his way naively, foolishly along the path towards the harlot? There's a foolish relationship we have with sin. We think we can play around with it, but as the Proverbs say, we can't take fire in our lap and not get burnt. It leads to friendship, infatuation, but then it betrays us. That's how idols work. They betray us, and it leads to worship, but it's a tragic worship, one that gets us, and we can't just decide, oh, I'll get out of this, because it now has hooks into us, teeth into us. There's a bondage there. The way out is doing violence, as Ed talks about, against addictions. It's a response to God's grace. We engage in the battle against distorted affections. We remember God's commitment to us, because that's what's going to sustain us and enable us to keep moving, because if it's up to us, we fail, right? We surround ourselves with wise counselors. One of the biggest lies that people who struggle with shameful sins and things they want to cover up, they want to hide. And the way out is saying no to that and yes to being known. We serve a God who lives in the light. And God who lives in the light puts people around us so that we will stay in the light. Because deception is almost always our friend and around us trying to get us to stay stuck. We speak honestly and uncover subtle lives, and that right here where this this circle is where we're going to hang out for the rest of the time. We engage at the battle of the level of imagination, and we don't just focus on what's wrong with us. We delight in the fear and knowledge of the Lord. It is not enough, and many people who struggle with addictions spend all their time thinking about, I made it another day. I made it another day. And you know what? I'm not going to take that away from them. That's good. But that's not all. We want people to be thinking about something better. Something better than just not sinning. And that is their relationship with the Lord. The more we are at awe with who God is and how he pursues us relentlessly, the less attractive will our sins be. Here's another way that I have tried to use to get people to look at three prongs of the problem. First of all, obviously we start with our heart, which is fallen. We live in a fallen world with fallen communities and fallen bodies. We are deceiving and deceived. And in the midst of our trouble, we reveal what we really serve by our actions. One of our first actions is self-deception. Self-deception is a gateway drug or a gateway sin. You cannot possibly, as a Christian, engage in sinful activity without self-deception. Why is that? Because it would be psychotic to take something into yourself. It's like, here, drink poison. You wouldn't do it. So something has to make it possible to drink that poison. And that's self-deception. It's also the deception of others. It's the lies we tell ourselves to make other sins more palatable. If we were to see ourselves as we really are, says Richard Sibbes, we couldn't take it. We could not ingest or accept things that are evil. These things often come in the form of needs or normal desires. You've probably had people, you've probably said it. This is something I need. I need respect. I need love. I need, and then when we don't get it, then that gives us the right to go after things in ungodly ways. Along with self-deception leads to false worship, which we saw in that descent that Ed has in his arrow. False worship is done daily, hourly, by the second, in the most subtle ways. You can find it in a quote-unquote innocent second look, the momentary daydream, the place you go when you have nowhere else to go. I like to talk about with folks, where do you go in your mind when you're in the shower, when you're waking up, when you're falling asleep, when you're in the car and you don't have the radio on? That will probably tell you something about what's really important to you these days. And if you look at that frequently, you may start to see patterns. What is it that I most cherish? Is it peace? Is it control? Is it protection? Is it safety? Is it attraction and excitement? Is it being the center of attention? What is that? Is it having financial security these days? Any one of these things may not be false worship, the things that we like and think about and desire, but a quick review of that may show your must-haves. So we have the two prongs of self-deception and false worship. It leads to you acting, which is your habits, right? And habits are where our bondage takes place. Once a habit is formed, you can't just turn it off. Have you ever tried to change your eating habits? Have you ever tried to change some other habit, working out, something? It's discipline. We don't like discipline, but it takes the discipline to do it. And without much help, we can stop the discipline. If you've ever lost a few pounds and felt a little bit better about yourself, what happens? You go back to the old eating habits. If you ever got to the point where you really worked out, maybe you stop working out. You know, I can skip a day or two. I get into the habit of reading the Word. Well, you know, it's okay if I skip a day or two. These habits we form have a way of keeping us in bondage. Now, the work of counseling and the work of discipleship is dealing with all three. I forgot to put this up here. Habits are not just merely acts, but they begin to take on a life at the cellular level. Your body may crave food, drugs, pornography. Even after years of saying no, you may still struggle with them. So, how do we get out of this? We need to break down deception. That's one prong of the attack in counseling. That's fighting for the truth. We fight for the truth how? Well, we have to challenge thoughts of ourselves. We have a way. We have scripts. We have images. James says we look in the mirror and we walk away and it's easy to forget what we see. Well, we have an image of who we are. We are wounded. We are hurt. We are mistreated. We have less of the image of we are a sinner. We are actively seeking our own way. And one of the biggest problems we face is forgetting that we are lost sheep. If you're lost, what do you know to do? Stand still, somebody's going to come find you, right? If you keep circling around, you're going to get yourself more lost, and the people who are looking for you can't find you. And this is really true with our Christian life. We keep thinking, oh, I think I know how to get out of this. And we go, and then, well, how did I end up here? And here's how this plays out in addiction. I'll have a client who will come a few sessions, things feel a little bit better. You know what? I got this thing beat. And then they fall back into the pattern because they haven't really laid down new habits yet. They haven't new worship focus. So they keep finding themselves and keep getting lost. Proper worship. Proper worship sounds like, well, yeah, of course, we're going to proper worship. But what is that really when it comes down to it? It might be just meditating on one thing. In the last one, I used the example of, last talk I used, you know, Psalm 131. The one thing of being a weaned child sitting in the lap of a mother, sitting in the lap of God, what does that mean? Well, it means not grasping at other things. And so I'm just going to meditate on this. I'm going to read this 6 verses of Psalm 131, morning, noon, and night. I'm going to tape it up places. I'm going to meditate on this because that's all I can do. I can't think about anything bigger, anything more complex, because I'm in a fog. And this is the one thing I can do. And the third prong of counseling and discipleship with addictions is beginning to build new habits, doing violence to bad habits, and using all the means of grace. It might mean that you use medications. Now, medications are sometimes seen as a bypass of spiritual growth, and they can be. But the problem isn't the medication, it's the person who's trying to bypass the spiritual growth. Medications may, as I have found out, help a man, an antidepressant may help a man stop craving pornography just a little bit so that he can set up better patterns. Here's another one that I see that's not medication. I've had men say to me, why do I need a filter or a monitoring software on my computer? Shouldn't I be able to do this and say no to sin? Isn't that what God calls me to do? Wouldn't that be maturity? Aren't I just using a crutch? Are you crazy? Would you live over the little heroin shop if you're a heroin addict? No, you get up and move. This is part of the habit change. And you don't say no to any possible means of saying no. We'll work later on the right motivation, potentially, but it's good just to say no. So that's the foundation work. Let's make a move here to my thesis. Knowing the end point on a map is important. You need to know where you're headed, and that's what we've just been looking at. But you must not neglect the starting point. for the person that's in front of you that you're working with, nor the process by which you get from point A to point B. And the second half of my thesis is sometimes, and I include myself in here as a biblical counselor, sometimes we biblical counselors have a really good vision for where we're headed and what's wrong with us, but we're not as careful on the details on how you get there. Now, there's some reason for that, and good reason. You never want to say, here's three steps to get to sanctification, because as soon as you do that, Oswald Chambers says, you lose the spirit. There's no magic three steps. And anybody who sells that stuff, you want to be suspicious. At the same time, we don't stand on the top of the mountain. We go down into the valley as Jesus did. And we get down in the mud. We hold their hand and we start walking. And that's what this talk is about, is what are some of the practical things? Again, they don't save anybody, but there's some possible things that you might use. Here's the two techniques. One is more insight or educational minded, and it's the cycle of addiction. And the second one is the process by looking at how you look at the person you're working with, where are they in their level of motivation for change? And you tailor your work depending on where they are on any given day. All right, the cycle of addiction. Most individuals have a common pattern from and vicious cycle from abstinence to addiction. And it can be discovered. Most individuals, secondly, do not adequately see and understand the subtle details of how they get from point A. I don't know how I did that. I just got there. I don't know. I have no idea. None of them decided, ooh, I want to be addicted to this substance. How did I get there? And when you first meet with people, they say, I don't know. I just did. I was just using. I was just drinking. I have no idea what happened just before that. Learning the cycle of addiction may help the person become more alert to temptations, vulnerabilities, the lies, self-deception, as well as the way of escape. And you are helping them when you use this, wake up from a coma. Most people who struggle with long-term addictions, whether it's sexual or drug or a substance or anything else, gambling, they are in a fog. They do not have clarity of thought. And part of your job is to walk alongside of them as they're waking up as if from a coma. When you wake up from a coma, I don't know this personally, but you can't really make out what's going on around you. You don't really understand your surroundings. If you're waking up and you're walking in a fog, you can't see clearly. Part of your job is to help them see clearly. So here's the cycle of addiction. What I do when I start working with somebody is I actually draw this out in a rather crude way. And I tell them this is a general cycle, and my job is to understand your cycle. And it might look a little bit different. But I start up here as most people have that time in their life where they say, you know what, I beat this thing, never again. Man, it feels good to be free from this. And then some triggers happen. And these triggers can be environmental. They can be other people in their lives who either mistreat them. It can be positive things. I know frequently that people who struggle, who have a positive event, a victory in their life, are then prone to go to the addictive thing because they normally associate the addictions with celebrations. The celebrations from this positive thing leads to this temptation. So there are triggers. It can be lack of sleep. It can, and so when you know that when you lack sleep and you get up, you're more likely to be irritable, right? Well, the person who struggles with addictive patterns is going to be more likely to be tempted. It can be somebody puts something that's tempting in front of you. That's a trigger. Triggers lead to tempting thoughts. I need a little bit of peace, a little bit of celebration, a little bit of comfort, a little bit of... If you ever read the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis talks about this woman who just wants just a little wee tea of toast. You know, not too much to ask for. He calls her a glutton. And that's what it is. It's just this little thing, not too much. Which leads to suds. Now, what are suds? Suds are seemingly unimportant decisions. If you have a problem with internet pornography and you decide, you know what, I'm tired, it's the end of the day, I want to see how the Dow went, I want to see what's economic, you know, what's going on in our economy. A couple weeks ago, I want to see who's winning in the, you know, the elections. Oh, how did I get here to pornography? That wasn't my plan. Seemingly unimportant decisions. I put myself in an at-risk situation. Seemingly unimportant decisions. I'm lonely. I start calling people, and I happen to speed dial the person who I've had a sexual liaison with several times before. I get in the car, and I'm just driving around because I'm bored. And I ended up at the spot where I tend to do this addictive thing. Which, of course, goes into the indulgence. And I can handle it. And we all have experienced this. Haven't you ever decided that you weren't going to have any more potato chips for a while? Yeah. And you eat one. Oh, well, I guess I'll eat the whole bag because I've already ruined it. That's that vicious cycle within a vicious cycle. The defeated interpretations which say, I'll stay with it. Here's how it happens in counseling. I'm going to see Phil in a week and a half and I blow it. Well, I guess I'll keep blowing it here for the next 2 or 3 days, but then that'll give me about a week to be clean again, and I can come in and say, yeah, I had a bad day, but I really had a good week. That's that defeated interpretations that keep us down there. I've already blown it. I'm already defiled, as Mark Driscoll called. I might as well stay defiled. Dirty girls do dirty things. That's that defeated cycle. Leads to guilt. At some point, somebody just can't take it anymore. They get out. And they feel guilty, and it often leads to penance. Not repentance, but penance. And what does penance look like? It often looks like, you, God, stay over there. I'm staying over here because, you know, you probably don't want much to do with me anyway. I've kind of screwed up. And I'm just going to do a little of this kind of penance, you know. And at some point, I'll start to feel better. And then me and God, we're good. And I'm back at that abstinence again. Now, you can see that there's some lines here from the triggers down to the indulge. I can handle it. You do it frequently enough, and you go right straight from triggers to there, and that's why the person in front of you, I don't remember any tempting thoughts. I don't remember any seemingly unimportant decisions. I just went from here to here, no thoughts. And they're right. Part of your work is to start back here indulging. What just happened just before that? And what just happened just before that? What were you thinking, feeling, doing? And what just happened before that? And you're helping them become more conscious of what they do, how they think, what lies they believe, how they've interpreted the world, how they are functioning. There's two reasons why you do this. They need to wake up. There is a second reason, which I don't usually tell people too much, but the reason is, would you want to keep talking to a counselor in the nitty-gritty, fine details of your shameful sin pattern? You don't usually. And some people have said, you know what, Phil, I knew you were going to make me go through that pattern again. And that was one of the things that kept me clean this week. That's not where you want them to end up, but I'll take that right now because that means they didn't add more damage to their soul. Ways of escape. Second thing I do with them is I say, okay, we now have become very good at understanding your cycle. And by the way, I would do this multiple sessions each time. And even if they didn't go into the indulge, but they had tempting thoughts, we would keep looking at the pattern. The more you look at the pattern, the more likely they're going to become aware of it. The more likely that they're going to be able to take one of these paths of escape. But if 1 Corinthians 10:13 is accurate, there are ways of escape throughout this cycle. There are ways to get out. So when you're triggered and you're tired, what do you need to do to make yourself more strong? And who are you going to call? And what happens if you can't get the first three people? And what if it's at 10 o'clock at night? And then what? And then what? These are ways of escape. These are just putting feet on the gospel. If God provides a way of escape, then let's know it. Let's define it. Not because it's going to become some legalistic thing we do, but because it's true. Tempting thoughts. What are the ways of escape? Seemingly unimportant decisions. I'm already online. How do I run? You know, what are my ways of escape that will keep me from doing seemingly unimportant decisions? Even when I have indulged, how do I just have the one potato chip rather than the whole bag? How do I get out faster? Because the faster I get out and I get my community involved around me, the more likely I'm actually going to be able to pick up that phone and call before I indulge. Because I've become aware. I am no longer, as the scriptures say, I have no longer burned my conscience, so I'm not even aware what's going on. But I have become aware of what God is doing, and I have become aware of his still small voice in me when I'm in trouble. So that is just one little technique to help people walk through their cycle. Why would you do this? And here's the, this is the work we just did, uncovering subtle lies. I can't help myself. No, there are ways of escape. And we're engaging at the battle of the level of imagination by imagining other ways of functioning. Right? Now, where does this fit in the process? Most people who struggle with addiction struggle with heavy, heavy shame. And they don't believe that they can really defeat it. Believe me, if they thought they could, they probably would have done more work and would have defeated it with God's help. They think it's not possible. When you go through this cycle, you are actually showing them, no, there are ways. You are actually giving them some hope that it could be different, that God can help me be different. So you're addressing shame. You are practicing hope and worship in the midst of brokenness and despair by going through this. This is gospel stuff, even though that cycle of addiction doesn't sound very biblical. You know, there's not a lot of verses attached to it. They're dealing with the roots, shoots, and fruits of their addiction. They're dealing with their denial, their self-deception, their impulsivity, their complacency, their self-talk. Nothing is going to be allowed to just be hidden. You're going to validate their actual desires. Because one of the things that a lot of addicts do is they deny that they should have any desires at all. I would like to have no desires. Then I won't struggle. No, you do have desires, and they were God-given. How now are we going to handle them in a godly way? Addiction always tries to deal with them right now. God's plan never pays off in the now too often. It does, but not as easily as a shot of heroin. But it does pay off. And so how will we handle those, that emptiness, that loneliness, that loss of a relationship? How will we handle that anxiety? How will we handle that pain in a godly manner? This cycle offers them accountability. If you go through the ways of escape and you have a list of 40 people that they're going to call before they exhaust their list, you now have offered them accountability and practical ideas of what it means to say no to sin. And you, when you go through this cycle, you're going to find out how they said no, and you're going to say, whoa, this is great! Because very few people who struggle with addictions have anybody cheerleading them. Most people are saying, yeah, that's good. So you've been clean for a week. You know, I've had to put up with you for 40 years doing this. Yeah, we'll see. It's really true. We see from research that actually family members of people of addicts sometimes do things to put them back into their addiction. They didn't cause it, but sometimes they pull the rug out because they're angry with them and they want to punish them. So when you see them saying no, even if it's for mixed motives, this is a cause for celebration. When the prodigal came home, did he have great motives for this? Absolutely not. But the father runs and grabs him and celebrates. And you too need to run and celebrate because there's not too many people celebrating their successes. Okay, second technique. Stages of change. Not every person who struggles with addiction, not any person who comes to counseling or discipleship is actually wanting to change. Some don't. Some come with a gun pointed to their head. If you don't go to counseling, if you don't go see pastor, if you don't go to that group, I'm leaving you and the kids are coming with me. That person who comes probably isn't highly motivated. They may be motivated to come, but they may not be motivated to change. So it's important to know where they are. There are, though, some people who are highly motivated to change, but they are afraid. It's going to cost too much. If I tell my wife what I was doing, if she learns this, she'll leave me. It'll cost too much. I can't be known like that. I'll lose my position. I'll lose the, you know, people look up to me and respect me. I'll have none of that. So some people want change, but they're afraid of the cost. And all of us, you included, are fickle. And sometimes you want change and sometimes you don't. James Prochaska, who is not a Christian, but a researcher and studies people who do risky things like substance abuse and unprotected sex, has discovered that there are commonly some stages of growth and change that people go through as they realize that they're doing something they shouldn't be doing and they move on. And I want to talk about that because a wise counselor continually assesses the person's openness to change and tailors their counsel to that place. We meet them where they are, not where we want them to be. Far too frequently, we stand up here and say, you come up here, and it's good to have vision. But that's not the way of Jesus. Certainly not the way of Jesus with the woman at the well. He doesn't start in by telling her what's wrong with her. He doesn't tell her to come to Jerusalem. He goes to her place and asks her for something. The woman caught in adultery. Does he start with a litany of her sins? And where she, you know, you need to live a righteous life? Where are your accusers? So you go meet them where they are at. And far too frequently, we counsel figments of our imaginations. We want them to be here, but they're here. Okay, so here are his stages of change. We'll go through each one of them and look at both what's going on in their life. What do you see? so you can become aware of it, and how might you approach it? Pre-contemplation is the stage where that proverbial gun to your head. You're going because you were forced to go, and if you don't go, something worse is going to happen. These people are not ready for change. They're not thinking even about it. You have people who are contemplating. They're ambivalent. Well, I know I should, but I don't know if I can. Really, do you think it's going to get better? I don't know. I could try, but I don't think my wife will love me again. That's that ambivalence. I know I need this, but I'm just not sure. Determination, I'm doing it. We're starting Monday. Action, I've already done these things. Can you help me do some more? And then the maintenance is, I've made a lot of progress. I've never reached perfection, but I've gotten to the stable place, and now I'm trying to maintain that stability and not lose my way. So pre-contemplation, what are you dealing with? This person is reluctant to come. They are forced to come. They are rebellious, probably. They may, you know, if it's a teenager, they say nothing. If they are full of themselves, they start debating with you and attacking you. They're resigned. Well, she's going to leave me anyway, so what's the point? You know, why would I do this? Because, you know, she's never going to let me out of the doghouse. Rationalization, coming up with reasons for why this is okay. And your goal is one thing. Move them from not thinking to thinking. Now, how do you best do that? Have you ever been defensive about something, done something wrong, and somebody got really big and angry with you? Guess what? It probably didn't make you more vulnerable, did it? It probably made you more defensive. Yeah, but you, right? Isn't that what we do? Why is that? It's because this person, I mean, there's something to do with us, but the environment is one of these ones where we reflectively defend. So how do you do this? You need to stay, when you're working with somebody in this stage, stay very soft. You're not pushing them. They have a lot of people pushing them, telling you, you better. And they, So you stay in more of a neutral stance. What are the options? What else can you do? What's going to happen if you don't? And again, you're not, well, what's going to happen if you don't? But it's more of a, tell me, what's going to happen here? You don't argue. You avoid all labels. They have plenty of people labeling. You raise doubts. You empathize with their stuckness. You provide choices that they may not see. And here's one that I do with somebody I think doesn't want to be there. Tell me this. I know you don't want to be here, but if one thing could change out of coming to counseling, what would you want it to be? I don't know. Well, okay. So that's your homework. If you come back, think about that. Because you're not going to give them any other. They're not going to read something you give them, most likely. They're not going to do any homework that you give them, but you might get them to think. And they might come back and say, I wish my spouse would get off my back. Well, guess what? We probably don't have a whole lot of power over that, but that's a connection point that you now have. They've opened the door, maybe a hairline, but it's still a crack. That primary emotion, secondary emotion, this is my best example of it. My wife, when we first got married, and I had a different view of time. Time for me is 5 minutes early. That's your on time. And she's not really late, but she's kind of European herself in the sense of time. But here's how it came up. In the first year, she went to some event at a professor's house, and it was all fine. It was a big group, and this is before cell phones, so you couldn't text or find out, are you still there? Supposed to be home around 8:30. I don't know what time it was. It was an hour later, and she wasn't home, and I'm freaking out. And I'm upset, and she's dead on the side. I called the house. She wasn't particularly happy that I called, you know, checking up on her. What is this, you know, going on? And she was probably right to be upset with that, I will say. She comes in the door, though, when she does get home. Do you think I did the fear? No. Where have you been? Why were you late? That's so rude. And so you see my naivety and immaturity. I didn't share the vulnerability, the hurt, the fear that I had. Why? Because I'd like to cover that stuff up and protect it with anger and defensiveness. And so when you're working with somebody pre-contemplation, you want to get them past that protective outer shell. And the way you do that is with softness and vulnerability. Contemplation. What are you dealing with somebody who's contemplating? They're ambivalent. Is it going to be really better? Can things change? Isn't it going to cost too much? Your approach. Information, incentives. Not begging, but incentives. I could see that this could happen. If you try this, what would happen? You give them reasons for change because they need more reasons. You stay open. You listen. You affirm that there is a cost. And maybe some homework you have them do is do the risk rewards. What are the risks of change? What are the rewards of change? There are real risks of change. You can try and fail. You can try And other people won't accept that you're trying, and they'll still say you're failing even though you're not. There are real risks for people seeking the path to Christ, and we ought to be able to identify them. So, you want to be able to do that staying open, affirming. Again, this whole process is understanding where this person is in front of me, and can I give them homework, and can I treat them in a way that helps them move forward? What are you dealing with in the determination? These are people who are acting. I'm going to do it. They're acting on strength and some truth. They're prepared. This is the best counselees and discipleship persons. They want to do something, and they're going to do it whether you are there or not. Now, what's your approach? Strategy. Just because they have intentionality doesn't mean that they are thoughtful about it. They have some ineptness usually. They haven't thought through all the things. And your job with somebody who's determined to change is to think about what are the barriers, how can we support success. That cycle of addiction is, okay, what do we need to know at each one of these layers? It's you're getting them to focus on the details. You're removing the barriers to this. What do we need to do? What happens at 10 o'clock when you're tempted? Who are you going to call? Who do you know that you can call? Who can you email? Who can you text? What can you do if there's nobody available? What next? What next? Those are all the fine points of details. Again, they aren't going to bring healing, but they make healing possible. The action stage. These are people who have already done something public. They're making changes. And maybe they are in that 3 to 6 month, what we call 3 to 6 month great stage. It's the honeymoon stage. I don't even have cravings. It's fabulous. Now, there's a little danger on the end of that 6 month stage. To some people, it might be a year. I had a friend who made it a whole year without going to massage parlors. We had a cake, we had a big celebration, and the next night he went. He was most at risk at that point of time because he had forgotten. He needed some help to think through what are the actions that you're continuing to do. So that's what's happening in that action stage. And what's your approach then? Don't get in the way to stop them and try to be too directive, but you want to talk to details. So what have you learned so far? What are you learning about what you're seeing? If you're waking up from a coma, you're learning things every day, and you want to give them the opportunity to talk about those and to recognize them. What you don't want is for them to have freedom from the addiction but not know why. You need to understand some of the reasons why. So you talk the details, and you get them to reflect. What's it been like? Because there have been real losses. What's it been like for you to do this? What are you noticing? What are you noticing about what God is doing in your life? Where is He speaking to you? Where is He working you? Where is He giving you opportunities to work in other people's lives? Finally, last stage, in the maintenance stage. You know what? You're working with folks who have a good track record of staying free from that sin pattern. And here you are getting them to look at their unexpected costs that come with this. Maybe lapses and relapses. One of the worst things that I've seen is when somebody has great success and then they have a small, minor setback or a major setback, but then they don't want to come talk to me or their counselor about it because they're filled with shame and they're back to that temptation of building fig leaves and hiding. And so you want to preempt that by saying, look, these things may happen. Sin is going to happen. It doesn't mean that you're just becoming fatalistic about it. It's just that part of our life until heaven. Now, how can we get back on the track faster and faster? How can we recognize how it has impacted other parts of our lives? So that's the approach. You expect it. You be realistic. You help them recycle. You come up with strategies to prevent relapse. So two small practical things to do. One is educational. The other is much more of understanding the person in front of you, recognizing they can go up and down on that chart, and that if I am exhorting them and giving them lots of homework, but they're not doing anything, it probably tells me that they're not ready yet, and I need to go to where they are rather than hauling them up to where I am. But homework, let's just do the pre-contemplation. You're probably not giving any homework. In the contemplation stage, pros and cons, cost benefits, maybe some light reading, thinking that what's one little change you'd like to make. In the determination phase, you're doing a lot of cheerleading, a lot of work, a lot of building supports. You're getting them to journal a lot about what they're learning and what God is doing in their lives. In the action phase, you're keeping track of successes because most people keep track of lack of sin. I didn't fail, I didn't fail, I didn't fail. But what you want to keep track of is what is God doing in your life and what are those successes that we can celebrate. You're doing a lot more Bible study at this point because they're probably less fuzzy. somebody who's coming out of a substance abuse, you don't want to give them tons of study in the beginning because it's just not even going to be remembered. It's all fuzzy. And then in the maintenance stage, you're helping them grow in wisdom for the long haul. Now, as you're doing this, I got to remind you, don't forget the basics. In order to be successful in any kind of counseling and discipleship, you need to join with them. Meet them where they are. You need to be able to evaluate and perceive what they need. You need to respond to them in love and empathy. You need to be able to probe and summarize and focus and challenge and set goals and get doing action. But none of that is going to happen if you do not listen. Your first and primary tool is listening, and that's not a passive listening, active listening, so that they know, you know what they're going through and that you care. Secondly, you've got to remember to set that stage for work by validating them, exploring with them, building trust and safety. If there's no trust and safety, are you really going to tell people your deepest, darkest secrets? You're not going to. They have to know they can come and tell you that they're an axe murderer and that you're still going to care about them. They have to know that you can't be shocked off your rocker. That cannot be forgotten. Don't jump into, let's fix them, let's get to the goal. Recognize you got to earn the right. Balance your teaching and your exploration and honest responding. If you're always teaching, then they may think that you're just in teacher mode and they give the Sunday school answer, right? The answer is preach the gospel, love Jesus, right? But you may miss the honest responses. So look at your balance there. Uncover any kind of denial and deception in love. Remember that. It needs to be done in love. Too often we're harsh and condescending. Offer that accountability and focus on commitment strategies. That's that last technique. How do they work to be more committed to what God is doing in their lives? Because we're a fickle people, right? We give up easily. It's not going to work. Ugh, we're defeated easily. And so part of your job, and maybe the biggest part, is to maintain their vision and commitment to the process. I will tell people who are coming through addictions, look, this is a 2-year process. In 2 years, you're going to look back and say, wow, life has really changed. But don't assume that 3 weeks, and it doesn't mean you're going to see me for the whole 2 years, but don't assume that in 3 weeks, this is all gone, no problem. Finally, don't forget that God is doing a work in you while you are working with somebody with addictions. Don't forget that. The frustration that you feel when they relapse and go back, it not only tells you something about them, it tells you something about you. And God is doing a work in you through this person. God has done a lot of sanctification through my children in me, through my wife in me, and through my clients and my friends in me. He's doing a work in me, and we need to be aware of that. So what does it tell you about it? What can you learn? You can learn about your own complacency, your own denial. You can learn about how you deal with brokenness in your life. Many of us Christians want to cover up brokenness because the story of Jesus is he comes, he rescues us, and it's all victory and sweetness and light. But it's not, is it? There is the valley of the shadow of death. Yes, he's with us. Yes, there is the table set before us. But there are archers with their bows drawn, ready to let go at any moment. That food that's there overflowing is not in a safe place, except for that the Savior is with us. And sometimes we run from brokenness because we don't want to see it in ourselves or in others. And we don't want to hear for the umpteenth time that somebody struggled and fell into their sin pattern. Okay, I'm going to stop there. This is the third and final way you can get these slides in case you want them. This is my blog site. Wisecounsel.wordpress.com. Again, you can get through it for biblical.edu. There's a link. But on this site, you can see the circle up there. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 tabs. There's a home tab, about me, articles, slides, some previous talks, as well as this one. These will not be, they're not there yet, so if you look at it tonight, you won't find it. It'll be there by Monday. And then some work that I do. This is where I put some personal and professional musings up. It's just my little fun outlet. So, that said, we have about 10 minutes for questions, and I kind of rushed through this, trying to get past the foundations to some of these practical things. These practical things, by the way, don't save people. Jesus does. But they give people tools and things to hang on as they're trying to understand what God is doing in their lives. So, questions? how do you break through the fog? That's the question. And how do you deal with somebody who is yet to really see what's going on in their lives? They're there because the fire is licking at the heels, and they're running as fast as they can, and you might be the way out. And they're hoping that one session will do it. And what do you do? Well, there's no shortcut here, but at that kind of person, all right, talk to me about what's going on. What is breaking in your life right now? What's going to happen if something doesn't change? How have you tried to change before? Because probably they have many, many, many times before. What didn't work? What would you like to see? What would you hope would come from counseling? So I'm just trying to get them into start envisioning and hoping again and change. I might say, if they are so in denial, here's something I see, and I don't know what the shelf life is like that for your family, but it's not going to be long. What next? Where will you be then? Most people do see that they need some change, but they're in that management phase. Can I just manage this stuff? And that's the kind of person where you're walking, well, how's it gone so far? I'm not a big fan of Dr. Phil on TV because he makes a lot more money than me, but I have some hair. But he says something which you got to be careful with this because it can come off sarcastic. But how's that working for you so far? And you know, that's sometimes something that, yeah, not so good. So maybe we should try something else. I think people need rationale because they are a people without sight. And they need some rationale that they can believe in and hang on to. And it may be only a partial one. It may not even be the best one. It may be superficial. But if it moves them one step closer to Christ, who cares? Other questions, comments, challenges? Well, that's that readiness for change, is more, I'm looking, I don't use a particular tool, but that's what that pre-contemplation to action is, that where are they on this? There seems to be a lot of ambivalence. There's a lot of rebellion. There's a lot of rigidity and harshness, and they want to fight with me. I don't think they're all that ready. Or somebody who's got a lot of action, and they've done a lot of things, but I think they keep questioning, and so they're really more in that ambivalent phase. So it's more of a, what do I see in front of me? Yes, sir.